people have powerful feelings about the traffic in Los Angeles. It says something that local officials warned motorists about a temporary road work closure on the 405 last year by calling it Carmageddon. Angelenos took the hint, and this weekend they're expected to steer clear of the latest 405 closure, named, of course, Carmageddon 2. That's how it is in L.A., a snarl of overstuffed freeways and commuters who keep their cool, except when they don't. KPCC's Stephen Cuevas has this profile of a punk rocker whose music expresses the insanity of L.A. traffic while extolling the virtues of public transit.
Couple of things you need to know about Eddie Solis. He lives in L.A., loves the band Kiss, and does not own a car.
Being someone who's from L.A., born and raised, and, you know, having a few cars in my past, I saw the city much differently through a different perspective through the eyes of a bus rider.
Want to stall way the back?
Sure. Line 18, Wilshire Western Station.
Just steps from the front door of his home, across the street from a tortilla factory in L.A.'s Boyle Heights neighborhood, Solis catches a bus that connects him with the city's subway and the commuter train he catches to his day job at an indie record label in Hollywood.
It just opened me up to, like, little neighborhoods, galleries, clubs, bars, just everything. Just seeing what's out there, little pockets of the city.
Solis's journeys aboard L.A. buses and subway cars informs a lot of the material on The New Los Angeles Part 1, Through the Eyes of a Bus Rider, the latest release by the singer-guitarist band It's Casual. In Solis's vision of a new Los Angeles, people abandon their cars, climb aboard public transit, and rediscover their communities. One song extols the virtues of the L.A. County Metropolitan Transit Agency's Easy Pass and the urban underbelly it introduces to the rider.
And that's a nod and homage to, you know, the people who know what you can even go cheaper and really beat the system and really steer away from spending money on gas and oil profits and all that. Is all it takes for me to witness racial tension, for me to witness illegal aliens. It's not to paint a negative picture, it's just my perspective of what is seen.
Off the bus and back on the street, we make our way past a jazz saxophonist playing for pocket change and down a long escalator to catch a train.
So, where are we now?
We're at the Red Line station, the Pershing Square station in downtown L.A.
And what's our destination?
We're going to go downstairs another tier, and about 5 minutes, we're going to get on the Red Line going northbound.
Okay, yeah. Let's go.
The Metro Red Line snakes from North Hollywood to downtown Los Angeles. It's the train that inspired It's Casual's signature tune and spawned a viral internet video. It was partly filmed late at night on a moving train as it hurtles from station to station. Solis thrashes away on his guitar and barks the lyrics, which celebrate the Red Line and call out the congested freeways that coil around Los Angeles.
Este es un tren de Metro Red Line a North Hollywood.
The thread that comes out of the record that ties everyone together is just like, be alive, don't be a victim of having a car.
An MTA spokesman said he couldn't comment on Eddie Solis's furious pro-Metro message, but the Red Line video was a hit at the offices of Move LA.
Eddie's done a good job. Thank you, Eddie.
It's the public transportation advocacy group headed by former Santa Monica Mayor Denny Zane. He liked the juxtaposition of Solis blissfully riding L.A. public transit in one scene with scenes of the band raging against those notorious freeway jams.
Eddie is all frantic when he talks about highways. And so mellow when he's like grooving on a skateboard and on the bus and on the Red Line, there's a metaphor for the transformation, you know, from the, oh my God, I just got to get out of the traffic to, hey, this is cool. I can mellow out.
Or you can blast the tune like Too Many People as you claw your way across Los Angeles by car, bus, or skateboard. Too Many People could also be a motto for It's Casual. Over the years, the band whittled itself down to a power duo of Solis and a rotating cast of drummers. So you may think the burly, bearded punk rocker just can't get along with freeways, with people, or his native L.A. Not true.
I love it. I love everything about it. I've traveled throughout the U.S. many times, and I could never look forward enough to coming back. The weather, the different cultures, the landscape. I was just like, you know what? Now I know why everyone moves to L.A.
Solis will bring the love and the volume during a Red Line mini tour next month. It's Casual will play a different venue within walking distance of several Red Line metro stops from Union Station to West Hollywood. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
That's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director this week is Nina Thorson. Seal Muller is our technical producer. We had additional engineering from Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman. Thanks to Hank Hadley at KCBX. Our online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Catherine Borgeson and Rachel Johnson. Tyke Hendricks is our elections editor with production help from Tina Lauerberg. We had editing support from Paul Rogers. Victoria Malione is our associate senior producer. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. The news director is Bruce Kuhn. I'm Rachel Miro. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the California Endowment. Health happens in schools at calendow.org. And Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information at chevron.com.
The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the 210, the freeways are not so nice. The 101, the 405, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. I-5, the I-10.
Los Angelesnista, your host, Edward Solis, my in-studio guest, Stephen Cuevas. How are you?
I'm good, Eddie. Thank you for this.
Yeah, thank you for being here. I'm very excited to expose you and your background to all my listeners. A lot of my listeners are sports fans, and, you know, they don't really like the San Francisco Giants, but you're from the Bay Area. But we're going to talk about all the great things that define your character that come from the Bay Area, all the music that you've, you know, taken in over the years and all your reporting history, all that good stuff. But how do you like the heat today?
Well, it reminds me of the Inland Empire where I was for many years reporting. It's not nice. I mean, one of the, you know, I just moved to Pasadena, and, you know, one of the selling points was that it would be a lot cooler. And this is only my second month in Pasadena after living in the Riverside area for about 8 years and reporting out there. And no, I'm used to it. I also lived in Texas for 3 years before that. So, you know.
Yeah, you know what?
It's not good.
Today's a very hot day, and tonight's a very hot night. It must be about 85 degrees outside. So, I mean, it's really uncomfortable.
Yeah. No, it sucks. It sucks.
Absolutely.
You were a big sweaty mess when I you know, saw you out in the street. So. I was too. So,
you know, as far as
and I thought it was going to be air conditioned in here. I mean,
are you kidding me?
Come on, you guys, really?
Well, you know what it is? It's the AC makes a lot of noise, and it's just going to drown us out.
Right.
As far as what gravitated towards me towards you, was the fact that you were so immersed in metal and hardcore punk rock. Mm-hmm. In 2012, when I had a lot of success with the new Los Angeles One, it's Casual's fourth record, and all the press that came along with the Red Line single, you know, I did a lot of interviews, and I got to know a lot of reporters. But you and I, you know, when the tape was done recording, we talked about metal and your background and how that was a big component of your upbringing, metal culture in the Bay Area. And in fact, can you tell us how being immersed in metal brought you into radio?
Yeah, I mean, I came of age in the early 80s metal scene in the Bay Area, which is, you know, for fans of the genre, is infamous. I mean, that era, you know, you're talking 1981, 1980, to the mid 80s, you know, Metallica had moved there. Slayer was playing a lot of shows up there, even though they were still based here. They never actually moved there. They were kind of considered part of the scene, you know, kind of brethren, you know. Exodus, of course, and just like a host of other bands.
But there was like Testament, Forbidden, all those other bands as well.
Yeah,
right?
Those bands came a teeny bit later. I mean, if you really want to break it down, but yeah, and then at the same time, you know, there was a really kind of vital, you know, exciting punk scene going on too. So some of us, not all of us, who were going to the metal shows would also go across the street to the Mabuhay Gardens, to the On Broadway, and see the Dead Kennedys, MDC, Crucifix, and whoever. You know, we gravitated more towards like San Francisco bands or bands from out of town. And to be honest, in retrospect, I kind of regret not paying as much attention to the LA bands because there was a kind of a competition like LA. So I never went to go see the Germs, or I don't even know if the Germs ever even played up there.
So it was very regional as far as the fan base from the Bay Area would always pick and choose the hometown favorites over.
Some. I mean, there was a real rivalry back then.
Sure.
I mean, even in the metal scene too. And like when Slayer, there's a pretty famous story, you know, when Slayer their first show in San Francisco, I think it was, it may have been in Berkeley. Anyway, they were still wearing makeup back then. And the Bay Area metal fans were ruthless. And they heckled Slayer for wearing makeup. Take off the makeup, you fucking posers. Take off the makeup. Right. That was the last time Slayer wore makeup on stage.
So that was the last time?
That was the last time. And then, you know, they still had like the leather and all this stuff. And people just like loved the music, but were like, man, just not hanging with the leather and the makeup, and it's too much like Motley Crue, man.
Yeah.
This is what we're against. You know, that kind of thing, like the whole Sunset Strip thing. You know, that's why Metallica couldn't make it in Los Angeles. They couldn't get gigs. You know, the fans weren't as rabid for them because the whole Sunset glam shit.
That excessive mentality attached to that scene was just dominating.
Yeah, Metallica was just like this fish out of water in Los Angeles. People have to, that's why they moved, not only to secure Cliff Burton as the bass player, because he was from the East Bay, but to get out of that scene, you know, down here. So, yeah, I mean, I was like a 14 year old kid would take public transportation into San Francisco or wherever from the South Bay. Yeah, that became my sort of entryway into radio via KUSF, affiliated with the University of San Francisco, but was more just like your straight ahead college radio station. They had a metal show that was started by Ron Quintana, who also had one of the first like metal zines of that era,
yeah, right,
and covered all these bands. And now, you know, he's pretty well known. He's actually the guy who coined the word Metallica, which Lars Ulrich stole for the band. It was going to be the name of the zine he was working on, which became Metal Mania, which I also wrote for. But Metallica was one of the possible names for this scene. And Lars, you know, they were friends. He said, "No, man, I think Metal Mania is better. Metallica, I don't think that's good." And then, you know, a couple months later, you know, Lars, "Oh, I have this band, man.
And
you
it's
know?
Called Metallica.
It's called Metallica." And he's like, "Oh, really? Yeah, no kidding, you little weasel." So Ron started this show with Howie Klein, who went on to be this record label executive guy, and a couple other people. And then, you know, I was a fan of the show, and then I met him somewhere or another. And I just sort of ingratiated myself. You know, you hang around enough and go to enough shows, you run into the same people. And I think just one evening, he said, "Oh, you guys should come." Me and my friend Brad, who was with me and was also became like a co-DJ, said, "Oh, you guys should come to the show. You know, bring your stupid records that I don't have, and you know, maybe I'll let you play it while, you know." And so it started out like these two little kids who didn't do drugs or drink or anything. When the big kids, you know, Ron and stuff, would want to go do things that more adult kids do.
Sure. They would step away and you would come on in.
Yeah, the little goody two-shoes could come and play their silly punk rock records. And before you know it, we were doing that on a regular basis. So, yeah, that was my entryway into radio.
And then from there, you just got really, just really inspired by being behind the console? And
Yeah. I mean, I just got more into the business, and I knew I didn't want to, you know, there was no money in doing Rampage Radio and
sure.
And playing Slayer records. And I knew enough being around KUSF and stuff that I didn't want to be around record label guys and, you know, that whole scene. And so in the meanwhile, I'd sort of gotten into public radio just because I had a job where I could listen to the radio, you know. And I think I got fired from a job. And I was like, fuck it, you know. Oh, I said I wouldn't swear in front of a mic, even though I'm okay.
What happens? First segment, it's already out there.
Potty mouth. And so I said, well, I could go back to school to qualify for an internship at KQED in San Francisco. Because I was interested in how they presented stories on air. I was interested more isn't from a sonic kind of point of view, like how do you tell a story and work with sound? You know, it wasn't really about wanting to expose something at City Hall or something. It was just I was interested more sonically than
and the translation of it.
Yeah,
really? Yeah.
And so I did that. I went back to school to the City College. Qualified for an internship, got in, was with the California Report.
Okay.
You know, I was an intern in the mid-90s. And then after a couple of months, I sort of learned the craft well enough to start trying to do my own stories. And eventually that led to me freelancing for them, you know, and that's how I really learned the craft of reporting, the skill.
And that's how you hone in on your craft as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't go to J school, journalism school or anything like that. You know,
it was really like
it was by doing
your feet
it.
Wet, jumping in.
It was by
the
doing it. It was like yeah. old school, like you hear about these old newspaper guys or TV guys. That's how they did it. You know, they started like, well, yeah, I was 16 and I started as a copy boy and just started doing.
You're around
this and
the
that.
Business.
Yeah.
You saw how things worked and you just dove in.
Yeah. And one day the editor said, go cover this fire. And before you know it, you know, I was on the, you know, on the city beat or whatever. So it kind of happened like that. And yeah, I freelanced for them forever and then got a real job in Texas. Then got
where did you work in Texas?
KUT in Austin is the public radio station there.
Okay.
Which was mostly a music station, but they were just starting this newsroom when I started, so I was one of the first reporters there. And I was there for about 2 years and then kind of flamed out cuz The editor was crazy, is crazy.
Is crazy.
Yeah, yeah. So I just, you know, walked out in a very dramatic fashion one day. yeah, and then I just freelanced for like NPR and other national shows from Texas for a while. And then while looking for a job, and then lo and behold, a job opened up at KPCC, you know, the big station here. Yeah. And they were great. I loved them. They loved me, and they wanted a bureau in the Inland Empire. I didn't know shit about the Inland Empire, but you know, I learned pretty fast.
Meth labs and warehouses, right? Am I close?
The whole meth lab thing, man. It's just so like overdone. You know, it's like
right.
You know, and the story there, if you want to know, the whole meth lab thing did happen, but by the time I got there in 2005, 2006, it was pretty much done because so much meth was coming from south of the border. From these super labs in Mexico, and it was so cheap and so powerful. There was really just they flooded the market, right? Yeah, so there was no point
they
in
devalued it.
Yeah, there was no reason for you and I to open up our little meth lab in our
Hammett or Adelanto.
Some of those people may not know that you can actually get meth really cheap and you know, it's really powerful now because there's Hammett. I don't know what to say. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you a question. So in Mexico, they call those the super labs.
That's what, yeah, like some cops that I talked to, like called them, and they basically said the whole meth lab thing, it's done. You know, you're just not hearing those stories anymore. Houses blowing up. It happens, but it's like you're pretty, not only are you stupid to do it in the first place, you're stupid to do it because, you know, you can just, if you want to get it and use it, you just get it. And if you're, it's stupid to sell it because you're priced out. I mean, there's no money in it really, I don't think.
Gotcha. I mean, now let's talk about that. Coming from Texas, well, you went from Texas to the Bay Area, back to the Bay Area?
No, I went from Texas here.
Straight to the Inland Empire.
Yeah.
Now, the stigma that, you know, the Inland Empire has is one is the whole meth lab dynamic, the heat, and how it's developed, you know, in the last 30 years with a lot of track housing and warehouses, et cetera. Did you find it charming at all out there?
Absolutely.
Did you like it?
The really funny thing about coming here with no sort of preconceived notions about the region. I'd been to LA, family in Pacoima and Pasadena, coming as a kid and all that. But I didn't really know Southern California very well. What I found really funny is that, you know, I moved to Riverside and started work and found it a, you know, really fascinating place in a lot of ways. And then I would meet people, even colleagues who, you know, lived and worked in Los Angeles, and they would say like the most stupid shit about the Inland Empire and would like never like went out there. There's just this, you know, preconception about the region, about the people who live there and the meth labs.
That's the first one, right? That's top of the list.
Yeah. Oh, it's just a bunch of tract housing. Like, well, actually, some of those cities have some of the most beautiful craftsman homes in the region, you know, and some of the oldest neighborhoods as well, like the neighborhood I lived in the Riverside area. And, you know, a lot of the problems that people sort of throw on the Inland Empire are problems that are right here in Los Angeles, too, ladies and gentlemen.
Ah,
you know,
okay.
Meth, I think there was a pretty good amount of methamphetamine on the streets of Los Angeles.
But it came from the Inland Empire, though.
Oh. Of course. And of course, there's no other way.
There's no other way anyone got it from anywhere else. Yeah, of course.
And, you know, and L.A. exported a lot of its problems, you know, to the Inland Empire in the way of gangs and, you know.
Well, the system is kind of set up that way too, right? To push the riffraff out
I think not only that, I think a lot of people in the Inland Empire and the more in the desert area feel like they're the dumping ground for a lot of L.A.'s problems. I mean, literally. Like in terms of garbage, like actual garbage,
physical,
you know,
garbage.
Raw sewage type of stuff. And, you know, plants opened to take in that stuff and process it. So, you know, and there's always some sort of battle going on around stuff like that. And the warehousing stuff as well.
Yeah, I read a story you did regarding the warehousing and just the labor laws and
A lot of coverage of that.
Yeah, I found that very interesting because, I mean, there's so much of the warehousing going out. Or going on out there, and it's in mega, mega sizes.
Yeah.
I mean, was that pretty interesting to you?
I mean, it was like what I was most immersed in when I left KPCC.
It's ongoing.
Yeah,
because there's so much of it.
It was becoming like my main beat, kind of like warehousing.
Beat.
Yeah, because you have so many different issues all sort of crisscrossing there. It's not just warehousing and what's involved and the actual business,
the logistics of
the environment, politics,
immigration.
I mean, you have right now, like in the city of Moreno Valley, where there's a big warehousing project that's that was, you know, the city was trying to push through, and a lot of residents were very much opposed for various reasons, including environmental. They just felt like the whole process was skewed in favor of the developer. Well, now, like, everyone on the city council has been, like, subpoenaed by a grand jury, and the developers in hiding and all this stuff. I mean, I don't, you know, this has all happened sort of after I left the region, so I've not been covering it for KQED, but basically the whole thing is, like, collapsing in on itself, you know, and partly it's, some people believe, because the city council was so tied in with this developer to get this big warehousing project off the ground, you know. So it's become, you know, warehousing has become big money for a lot of cities that were struggling, you know, in the economy when the housing market crashed, because a lot of the economies were tied to housing out there, you know. And sure, it was great when people were buying houses and, you know, and you could make a lot of money. But when it collapsed, man, it was like, you know, taking the stopper out of your bathtub. Everything just sort of started going down with it, you know?
So this was another stream of income that they saw possible. That's why they got so involved.
But the concern is, like, well, now we're everyone's hitching their train to warehousing. But what happens when, you know, warehousing starts, you know, feeling? So, you know, on the one hand, it can be a boon, you know, for the economy. On the other hand, you're sort of selling out a lot too. You're selling out in the terms of land, in the environment, and, you know, the crush of trucks and other traffic on the freeways, and you have to accommodate all that. And so it's, everything comes with a price, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of components in between getting the manufactured goods to the warehouse to the store.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, like you said, you know, all the semis on the 60 freeway,
yeah,
et cetera. It's just, it could be a big mess.
Yeah. And, yeah, and there's been a lot of, I did a lot of coverage on all the, you know, the labor violations going on under the roofs of these, you know, gigantic buildings, you know,
and gigantic corporations, right? I mean, a lot of these, like the Walmarts and.
It gets very complex. Yeah, a lot of these warehouses contract through temp agencies, get a lot of their workers that way. So, they, you know, they don't have to pay them
health insurance.
And, right. Yeah, or might keep them under 40 hours so they don't have to pay certain, you know, certain things.
So, you know, at that point, they got to pay into the system. And, and there's more risk for the company as well.
Yeah. And then, you know, meanwhile, these warehouses are doing business under separate contracts with Walmart and maybe other companies. And so Walmart's, you know, I don't want to keep saying, you know, bringing Walmart into it, but they're one of the biggest players in this whole system. And so by having, you know, a warehouse that contracts with these middlemen, basically, these agencies, they don't really have to worry about all that. So when something comes up like, you know, temp agency A isn't paying its employees what they should legally be paying, or is shorting them on their paychecks, or is not giving them breaks, or the warehouse isn't giving them breaks, well, Walmart can just say, like, well, you know, we're not, you know, we just contract with these people. We can't be there all the time. And we told them, you know, they shouldn't be treating the employees that way. But what are we going to do?
Sure. You know? Now, present day, you're here in Los Angeles as the bureau chief for KQED.
Mm-hmm.
And you just recently covered a May Day march that mm-hmm. just took place here.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually used public transportation to get to L.A.
Mm-hmm.
from Pasadena.
Mm-hmm.
How did you feel about the goal line?
It was great.
It's pretty simple.
It was awesome. I parked in downtown Pasadena. They have like a little parking area just for users of the Gold Line. You just have to present your
tap card.
Your tap card, and it's free.
Free parking.
Yeah.
$5 day pass round trip.
Yeah.
You know. So it was one straight shot to Union Station, right?
Yeah.
And then I walked
from Union Station and caught up with the. I mean, I got there before it started. And then sort of got to the head of the, you know, the actual march and hung out for a while, talked to some crazy people and everyone. It was like a street party, really, you know?
It's a glorified street party, right?
Yeah, yeah.
With the press there.
It wasn't really like, but it wasn't really like, I guess I was expecting more of like a,
militant like groups.
Yeah.
So was I. I think I don't know. I think a lot of people are too lazy to get it together. They're just out there. It's a street party.
Everyone had a message, and everyone I talked to had very specific feelings about the immigration issue. But it was very much fun.
Committed? Did he seem really committed?
Yeah. I think there was a sense that because of where things are nationally in the whole debate, and it looks like something could possibly be passed by Congress, there was a real feeling of like we're winning, or maybe we have won. And we are going to see some significant changes in immigration policy. You know, I'm a little dubious. I'm a little skeptical that something's actually going to get passed. Because you know how that goes nationally in Congress. So, you know, I don't know.
Right. And as far as your experience taking the goal line, in my opinion, taking public transportation for 12 years consistently, I feel the goal line is the most scenic train that we have. Now, when you took it in, You went through, it was Pasadena.
Yeah.
Highland Park, Lincoln Heights.
Yeah.
And you're between the hills and this great scenery. I mean, was there a time for you to kind of look up and take a breath and see what was out there? Or were you getting your notes ready?
No, I was really scared. I was just clutching my backpack because I didn't know. no, it was very smooth. I really didn't notice the scenery too much. I just kind of looked up every now and then. It was okay. I mean, I think it made me want to sort of get back out there and really explore each line, like when I have time off.
Right.
And really just, because now I'm thinking like, oh, now I live so close, because I'm still thinking in terms of coming into LA and what that involves from the Inland Empire, like to go see a show or to go see friends, whatever. And now it's like
galleries, all that stuff.
And like tonight, it's like, I drove in, on the 110 and I was downtown in like 15 minutes. And I was like, wow, that's a trip.
Right. And without traffic.
I'm used to that.
Yeah, exactly.
I went to Dodger Stadium for the first time.
Yeah. We'll get into that a little later. I think all my baseball listeners are really curious to get a Bay Area perspective. This is your first time at Dodger Stadium.
Wait till I tell you what happened at Dodger Stadium.
Yeah. So when you got to Union Station, was that your first time there?
Oh, no. I had been there before, but... I was there. I mean, I'd taken Metrolink a couple times into LA for work.
From Riverside to LA, right?
Yeah. A few times.
Building.
It is very cool. It's very cool. I think when I first saw it was, I probably saw it when I was a little kid. I can't remember. But as an adult, I mean, recently since I've been living here, immediately you think of, I've seen this place. Well, of course, you've seen it in the movies. I couldn't cite which movies, but it's sure. It's been used in countless, films and TV and whatever. So, and it still has that. I really love the old LA, the noir stories, Chinatown,
right.
LA Confidential.
Absolutely. And, like the Mickey Cohen, Gangster Squad kind of.
Yeah. It has a romantic kind of thing to it, And you can still see vestiges of it. And that's really cool. That's what I love about LA. Because, San Francisco's like that in a lot of ways, too, which is where, I'm originally from. I've come to, as an LA hater, for so long. That's the way we are in Northern California, And then people in LA are like...
What's in your blood?
Yeah, people in LA are like, oh, I love San Francisco, man. We love to go up there.
We love the city.
It's so cute. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, God, I hate you guys in LA. and that was only reinforced as a kid, with Metallica and Slayer. It's like, see, man, it's like they're so fucking, those posers in LA, man.
They moved up to
Metallica
San Francisco.
Had to move up to here, man.
Yeah, exactly. And everyone's just copying Exodus down there.
And they're like Motley Crue and Rat, and we're like, oh, there was no good bands from LA back then. We thought there was
except for Black Flag.
I mean metal.
Yeah,
there was Armored Saint. They were okay. And that was about it, I think. If anyone else can name any good, early 80s metal bands from LA. Oh, there was Cirithungel, too. They were awesome.
Well, I mean, as far as thrash goes, we're talking the subgenre.
Yeah, there was no thrash bands.
No, it was all Bay Area.
Yeah.
It was all Bay Area. I mean, even Blast, like that SST hardcore band, they were from Santa Cruz. Yeah, when you talk hardcore, it was Suicidal and Black Flag, but everything else, metal, I would say the Bay Area wins.
Yeah, the hardcore
stuff.
The Bay Area wins when
it comes to metal.
For sure. But hardcore, you had Black Flag. That's all you needed.
Right.
After that, it's like, what are we going to do? They have Black Flag. Come on. And X. And the Germs. you know. But we had Flipper, Crucifix, MDC, Dead Kennedys, Tales of Terror, you know.
All the essentials.
Yeah.
Yeah. So your role at KQED as the LA Bureau Chief, I mean, are you pretty overwhelmed with, I mean, a market this big? Tell us, I mean, is there a lot going on for you?
Yeah, it could get pretty overwhelming. But you just sort of have to take a little nibble one at a time. And then, you know, everyone, you know, people have their expectations for what they'd like to see come out of the Bureau. And so you have to fight back on that a little bit and just be, you know, hold your ground. I mean, part of what I'm doing, too, is sort of trying to build up like a network of stringers, of freelancers who can do work for us, who aren't tied necessarily to any of the big stations down here. Some of them are younger, who are not, you know, who still have to get their
jobs.
Yeah. But you want those people
in your circle because they got their ear to the street. What's happening, right?
And I want people I can send to Antelope Valley or to Riverside County or the Imperial Valley, you know, to get some crazy stories.
More than LA.
All of Southern California.
Yeah, it's all of SoCal.
It's the LA Bureau Chief, but I don't, you know, I see it as the Southern California Bureau, you know. I don't want, you know, we have an office in just a few blocks from here.
Okay.
4th and Fig, I guess. We share a space with the show Marketplace.
Okay.
But I don't like to be there. It's just like this windowless office. And, you know, I can set up, you know, basically if you're a reporter, like a lot of other jobs, if you have your laptop and your recording gear, that's your office pretty much.
Mobile.
Yeah. So I can work from home and you make a few adjustments to things in the house. If you have to like track a piece or something, if you have to record, you know, climb into a closet or something. So you don't get all the echo of the room and everything.
Right.
But I don't like to be too tied in to downtown LA unless I have to be there for a specific reason, like the Mayday March or something
that's significant.
Yeah.
And relevant where it has to be covered.
Yeah. And it's kind of, you know, just the space for me to work, it's not really conducive to like good work. I mean, I can work just as easily from home
and comfortable, maybe,
and be close to the freeways. Right. And if something breaks and I need to get there fast, I can get there very fast from Pasadena. Like if it's inland or if it's downtown, whatever. So
nicely put. So we're going to take a break. Steven Cuevas was so kind to bring some tunes from his personal playlist. We're going to get into that right now. We'll be back with more Steven Cuevas.
Cool.
Hi, this is Eddie Solis. You're listening to Los Angeles Nista on SkidRowStudios.com. This episode of Los Angeles Nista is brought to you by La Mascota Bakery, a family-owned business serving the community since 1952. Tamales and sweetbread, made the old-fashioned way daily.
There are many ways one can die. Many ways one can achieve death. Many ways one can achieve post-mortem.
craziest motherfuckers I ever seen. You guys fucking blow away New York. They don't even like punk in New York. They think it's too fast or something. It never can be too fast, huh? Let's hear it!
It's the first time we ever came out here to San Francisco. Tell you what, we're closing off the year. I should say Berkeley. We're closing off the year and we're coming back and we'll keep coming back so you can all come to face the Slayer.
Yeah.
Hi, welcome back to Los Angeles, Nista. I'm Eddie Solis, my in-studio guest, Stephen Cuevas. How are you, Stephen? You good?
I'm good.
All right. So we're going to get a little Major League Baseball rivalry happening right now. Stephen just went for the very first time to Dodger Stadium, and he is from the Bay Area. So, Stephen, tell us about your experience and how many guys you got jumped by.
three scumbags from Fontana. I have to say first at the outset that I don't really follow baseball like I used to. I'm more of like a 70s fan.
Like, you know, Steve Garvey.
Yeah.
That era.
You know, LA had a great team. Right. Giants sucked, but, you know, I still love those guys.
Right?
Yeah. Back when, you know, baseball players still made as much as, you know, your average salary, basically.
And everyone had a big mustache. The Bill Buckner mustache.
Yeah,
right?
And they'd like take acid and get drunk before games.
Yeah, and then they go out there and do grand slams three times in one game.
Those were the drugs they took. Not like today, like with the steroids,
Right?
Yeah, they just took acid. Like, wow, man. Look at that ball go over the fence. So I had my current love interest. She is from Czech Republic. So she actually came to the U.S. for the first time just recently. This is just last month. And one of the things I said, like, oh, I don't know how we sort of, you know, I mentioned the Dodgers or baseball. I go, oh, we should try, you know, seeing a baseball game. Oh, I would love that. I would love seeing, you know, she likes sports and stuff. I said, okay, well, I'll see if they're playing. Like, when you're here, we can get tickets. And sure enough, they're playing. They were playing the Padres. They had like a homestand against the Padres.
Perfect.
Well, I was like, perfect. So we went like on a Tuesday and I got tickets, and I knew she is a little afraid of heights in certain situations. You know, she can go up into tall buildings, but doesn't want to get too close to a window.
Sure.
She can get up to like the Golden Gate Bridge, but she doesn't want to walk across. So I'm still kind of learning like what she can take and what she can't. When I go to a game, I like to sit in the upper decks just because I like the sort of bird's eye view.
See everything happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's just, it's cheaper. It's cool. I like it. But I had forgotten, like, well, it's kind of steep up there. You know, and I was
especially
like, well,
each park has its own story about how steep it is. And Dodger Stadium is like really vertical.
Yeah. I was kind of surprised by that. And she was terrified. So we went up there, and She couldn't go down the stairs. She was just like holding on to the railing.
Wow.
And so one of the Dodger, you know, I don't know what you would call them. One of the Dodger staff.
Like who, the ushers that were?
Yes.
Yeah.
Usher noticed right away and came right over and says, everything okay?
Wow.
I said, well, she has a problem with heights. I don't, you know, we're going to try to sit. And he said, well, don't worry. You know, there's handicap seating here. And if no one comes, you guys can sit there. It's right on, you know, the very back. If someone comes, you'll have to move, or you can swap tickets with someone. You know, just take one of these seats. And if someone comes, or you can get upgraded over here, one of these kiosks. But just take your time. You know, we got there, you know, really early, and he was so like accommodating and sort of helped reassure her.
Good customer service on the Dodgers.
Yeah. So she tried to sit down. It was just too much. I mean, she wasn't going to have a good time. So I said, just relax. I'll go over to the kiosk. And the woman there was so cool. You know, she was like, oh, yeah. You know, I go, just get me down closer to the field. I don't care what it costs because we're here. And we want to see this game. I just want things to be cool, you know? And she's like, oh yeah, no problem. You know, it's a pretty slow night. So, you know, I think I have to pay like $15 more just to get us down like to on first baseline.
Wow.
A little back. Amazing.
So you had like, you were like in the box or loge?
No, it was more, well, it was first baseline, but kind of towards outfield.
But still way
still
closer.
Really good. Yeah.
Wow.
And she, you know, my girlfriend loved it. I mean, she was just like, oh, wow, this is so good.
So the upgrade was like how much?
$15.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
At all.
I think she kind of cut us a break too. You know, she just liked us or something. And so she was cool. Then I went and got Dodger dogs, which I have to say, you guys really Dodger dogs? I mean, come on. It's just not good. It's not a good hot dog. That's my only complaint.
So you think they're overrated?
You know, you couldn't even get like a Polish hot dog or like
it's just
a,
one thing, man.
Something
Super
proper.
Dodger dog or Dodger dog?
That was my one. The woman who sold it to me was like a so sweet though. And we chatted for a little bit, older woman, and then I bought some fish tacos, which were not good either. I'm afraid. So coming, you know, if, you know, Pac Bell Park, I say has the food on you guys.
They do. Okay, but tell me about the customer service. You would say
outstanding.
Thumbs up. Outstanding customer service at Dodger Stadium.
Yeah.
And what do you think, like, as far as the facade, like, you know, the whole exterior of Dodger Stadium?
It's really cool.
The setting?
It's iconic. Yeah, it's iconic. It was cool to be there. So I have to say I'm not really a Dodger hater anymore. But it helped that they just got pounded by the Padres. So
you love that?
Well, I didn't, you know, I wasn't going to sit there and go, yeah, Padres, because I don't give a crap about the Padres either. But... you know, it's, come on, I'm a San Francisco guy. It was cool to see the Dodgers lose, okay?
Rub it in, just rub it in.
And if someone wants to start something, then you can kick their ass down outside. No, but it was cool. And it was, and they have those, I don't know what you call them, you can go down and sort of stand, I don't know how many rows back. And they have like these railing, like almost like in a pub where you could just sort of like lean and have a hot dog and a beer.
And instead of going to your seat.
Yeah. So we just like spent half the game like roaming around. And like at one point we were like right behind home plate and you could see the pitches coming right in. And man, that was outstanding.
That's a phenomenal perspective because you're like right behind the batter.
And you really get a sense for like how fast those balls are coming. And that's when you really get a good appreciation of the athleticism of these guys.
Yeah, the eye-hand coordination and just like, you know, committing to like, you know, that sport and how difficult it is.
Yeah, and that's what I love about the game. It's like, I could care less who's playing, really. And to be honest, like, yeah, Giants are great and everything. Dodgers are great. But I really don't care who wins or I can't.
But to watch a good game
tie
is a
myself
treat.
To, yeah, I just like watching the athleticism of it.
Absolutely.
You know.
And the calculations happening for each play. It's really, I mean, there's a lot of mental capacity holding the components of the game, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I have a hot tip for you, though. Mm-hmm. You ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
So the goal line in Pasadena, the next time you go to a Dodger game, you could take the goal line all the way into Union Station.
Okay.
And then when you get to go to the goal line, go left to Vignes behind Union Station.
Yeah.
And there's a free Dodger shuttle.
How often do they run?
It runs every 15 minutes, 45 minutes before the game. And not only that, it's just basically an MTA bus.
Okay.
And you just show them your ticket, or you can say, I'm buying tickets. They'll let you on. And it takes you all the way, not into the parking lot, but behind center field gates.
So how long does it take to go from Union Station to Dodger Stadium?
20 minutes in traffic.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
That's the hot tip.
So that's a good deal unless I really want to get there early, then I would just drive.
Well, I think they start 45 minutes before the game, and if you
time it right,
you could be in that first batch of people. So that's pretty convenient. I got to hand it to the MTA and the Dodgers for aligning themselves and making that, you know, happen, because I've used it a lot and it's really convenient. I mean, you don't have to worry about paying $10 and then parking all the way and, you know, nothing wrong with a walk, but it could be hairy when there's a bunch of cars, you know.
Oh, my God.
You know,
yeah.
And you're just trying to get into the park without getting hit.
That's crazy coming out of there. We left early, but I'm like, really? It's like one lane and there's this weird turn. That's the weird thing about LA. It's like so much of like the freeway on ramps and off ramps and the exits are weird and it's just not laid out well. You know, I've never gotten as lost in others as I've gotten in Los Angeles. I mean, I've been to cities all over the world.
Sure.
And I've never gotten as lost as I have in Los Angeles at times.
Not only is it, I mean, it's not public transportation friendly. I mean, it's getting better, but even to get around in this huge space that we call Los Angeles County, I mean, it's really difficult to navigate if you don't know where you're going. I mean, where have you gotten lost, if you mind me asking?
I can't remember. I mean, usually it's because it's involving like the 101 and someplace nearby, but it's not really downtown, and just the weird kind of some streets are one way and some exits, you know, just sort of funnel out in a weird way, and it's just confusing. I can't remember. There have been many occasions, and I should know, or trying to find my way back can be a real, you know, ball buster. Because right. You think like, well, I'll just come back the way I came. It's not the way it works.
Doesn't always work that way.
It's not the way it works.
Well, let's talk about Pasadena, because we always like to highlight a city in the episode, mm-hmm. and that's where you're currently residing.
Mm-hmm.
And have you had a chance to like go out and try some of the eateries or coffee places, anything like that?
Somewhat. I mean, and I was already kind of familiar with, you know, the parts that everyone already knows, like Old Town and everything. I'm kind of on the Altadena border.
Okay.
Which is interesting. I don't know all the history of Altadena. I know that had...
Isn't the Van Halen Museum there?
Yes. Yeah. I've been there.
Oh, really?
I did a story on that guy, Dave Anderson.
Now...
He's a kook.
Is he out of his mind? That's
he's
what I heard.
Out of his gore.
Okay, so...
But he's a genius.
How so?
He's a guitar genius.
He builds guitars?
He builds and repairs guitars.
Wow.
I mean, for some of, you know... Still, he has his own little, like guitar shop.
And where he works on guitars.
Yeah, at his house. Yeah, like he has this whole studio back there. It's amazing. And that's where the museum is. I freaked out because I was a pretty huge Van Halen fan.
Sure.
Like the classic albums.
We discussed this before, yeah.
The classic albums are just.
The first four.
I mean, they're crazy. They're so good.
I'm so into Diver Down.
Yeah. That's a sleeper of an album. It's got some, I mean, Eddie's work on that is just astonishing. I mean, the Absolutely. Sounds that
Hang
that
'em high, you know, a faster playing.
Oh, my
that?
God. I know.
Yeah. I mean, Alex, I mean, and they're not even like, I mean, because at that time, the punk rock that was happening was like the 77 Sex Pistols punk.
Yeah.
Where it's like just glorified new wave beats. Yeah. But this is like pretty much like.
There was nothing
thrash.
Like it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And those guys, I mean, to their credit, they were listening to a lot of the shit that like bands like Metallica listen to much. They have Budgie, you know, the classic Welsh power trio, who I love. All that heavy stuff, that was hard to find back then.
So these guys, I mean,
Black Sabbath and
right.
Montrose.
So Van Halen weren't these like, you know, glitzy guys out of L.A.
No
trying to like
way.
Play, you know, this like, you know, BS kind of music. I mean, they were drawing from heavy places.
They were hardcore,
yeah,
man.
Absolutely. And they were into playing loud and
fast
full throttle.
And yeah.
Yeah.
And where's I going? Oh, so he has, Dave Anderson has the guitar, was it an Explorer that... Eddie Van Halen played on Women and Children First.
Okay.
Which is pretty much like my favorite Van Halen album because it's just crazy. It's bonkers, that album. And it's heavy.
Very dangerous album. It's heavy and it's just like all over. And it's good.
And that's when they were starting to get like kind of commercial, like, hey, and they had some kind of groovy songs on the second album. And that album came out and it was like, bam. So yeah, he has that guitar in there. And then he has...
Well, let's back up. What's his history with Eddie?
He went to school with Eddie and Alex.
In Pasadena, right?
Yeah. So they were kind of friends. And he would go and see... They used to play like those house parties.
Right.
Van Halen did. Like even before like they were playing the clubs. Those were like the venues to play because people would have a house party and hundreds of people would come and people would sell tickets. And then the cops would come and then everyone would go and they would sell beer and whatever.
That would
so,
make more sense because a club, you'd have to get like the blessing from the booking guy here. Yeah. It's like, no, we're going to play here.
Exactly. So that's where like they learned. It's like the Chitlin circuit, you know, it just played like the backyard parties and like they learned how to play before an audience. And, you know, first they started, he played me tapes, bootleg tapes that like are not out there of like, it's Eddie, Alex and some bass player who was not Michael Anthony. And it's them playing like Deep Purple covers, Black Sabbath covers. And I think Eddie was singing.
I have a very interesting story that's linear to that. So mm-hmm. in February, I was flown out to Austin to go play bass for Black Flag at SST mm-hmm. and spend some time with Greg Ginn. He was trying to dial in a bassist for this new incarnation.
Yeah.
And we, you know.
Are you the bassist for the new incarnation?
No. But I can be called at any minute if something goes south.
Uh-huh.
The guy.
Who is the guy?
Dave Klein.
Accidents happen.
Accidents happen. Just like Thomas the Tank Engine says in his theme song. But anyways, how's that song go? Accidents happen every day. Like that? No, but anyways, it was nice to reconnect with Ginn because, you know, I worked for him
yeah.
for a while.
Yeah.
And we've always had a great relationship. And we spent our, we would jam all day and we spent our evenings talking about just, you know, great music. And I loved it. I loved it because he was just like so not having chicken foot. We were talking about chicken foot and he so was not.
That's Michael Anthony's and side
Chad
project
Smith
with.
And Joe Satriani. Yeah. And Hagar.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not good.
No, that's definitely not
so
good.
So we got into this Van Halen conversation and Greg was like, you know what? They're a really good band. His opinion, he goes, I used to go to the Proud Bird at LAX. There was this restaurant and they had like a big banquet room.
Yes. There's bootlegs at some of those shows.
The Proud Bird. And Greg was like, I would go and watch this band. They were so phenomenal. They played so loud and they had these heavy tones and he would play covers.
Yeah.
And exactly at that era, he told me that's when he was following them. And then their first record came out and he actually liked it. And then he would, you know, follow them and, you know, up into the arenas, you know. And
yeah.
Black Flag took off and wasn't really interested no more or didn't have the time to really follow. But he spoke very highly of their cover sets in those days when Eddie would be singing.
Yeah. And the last Van Halen album was killer.
Oh, I mean, A Different Kind of Truth?
Yes.
Chinatown.
Yes.
That's the song.
you know, and the way they work, I learned this, I forget who I was talking to. It was Dave Anderson and also, what's his name? The dude that runs the publisher that put out Murder in the Front Row. And anyway, he wrote a book on Van Halen. So he knows like a lot of the story of their records and how they came to be. Van Halen has always gone back to like an archive of demos from back then, including on the new record, Chinatown. There's a few other.
She's the Woman.
Yeah.
All that is old from the old log from the mid 70s.
Yeah.
And just taking those riffs.
Yeah.
And reading.
And a lot of people like look down on that. I'm like, why? That's just like pulling from the original DNA. You know what I mean?
Right. Those are all existing riffs created in that era catalog.
Yeah.
And saying, we're going to make a new record, going back and pulling those parts and rehearsing them, saying, okay, this is now a song.
Yeah.
Here's some lyrics.
Yeah. It's like their workshop, you know? Like Geppetto's workshop, you know?
No, I mean, but that record, I mean, I saw them 3 times on that last
Really?
Tour. I've never seen them.
Really?
And I've, over the years, the last decade, I've been getting into them more and more and more and more. And I was like, you know, I'm going to all 3 shows, LA and one in Orange County. And it was phenomenal. I mean, just the intro, the way they came out, there's no intro.
Wow.
Alex walks out with the house lights on and just starts playing double bass. And they just kind of like all come out.
They still got it.
Yeah. Oh my God. Oh my God.
So was Eddie, is Eddie clean? I mean, is he?
I don't know.
But I mean, his playing was good.
Phenomenal.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So the Van Halen Museum is in Altadena.
Yeah.
Which is adjacent to Pasadena.
Yeah, and just call it a museum is a bit of a misnomer. It's part of Dave Anderson's workshop.
It, right?
Yeah, yeah. And he really, it's like, unless you know Dave Anderson, you can't get in. It's not like the public can just show up and go, hey, I want to see the museum.
It's not
can
like
I
the Grammy Museum at LA Live, right?
No. It's Dave Anderson's house. It's like this, it's so weird LA. And it's like, he's a weird guy. He's very nice, but. You know, as we're talking, you know, I can tell this story. I don't think he'll care. What's he going to do? nothing illegal or anything, but, you know, we're there talking and he's playing me these old demos and telling crazy stories about back then. And so we're sort of wrapped up and we're standing in his garden and his plane goes overhead and he looks up and he goes, you know, they're at it again. I'm like, what do you mean? You know, it's like, oh, they're spraying again.
What?
You know? He believes like this whole like chemtrail thing, like that the government is like, he's like one of those conspiracy guys.
Oh,
and he believes that
Art Bell.
the like some shady forces are like, you know, spraying the population with some sort of chemicals. Up. Yeah. And like, yeah, man. It's like, I know, man. I know this guy, he got cancer, man. And it's like, he didn't smoke or anything. And, you know, and I'm like, are you kidding me? Dave, you live like a couple miles away from like a major freeway. You know, do you drink the water from the tap? I mean, come on, you're in a major, and you're worried about what the government is like spraying on you. It's like,
so that's how he's operating.
Yeah.
And he's at the Van Halen Museum in his house.
Yeah. But the dude's a genius. He's like a guitar genius. Like he works, you know, Stone Temple Pilots he worked for. And I'm sure just like any band you can tell somebody. He has an uncashed check in his studio from, what's the dude from Stone Temple Pilots who always was flaming out?
Weiland?
Yeah, because he did some, he fixed like one of Weiland's guitars. I mean, Weiland's just like a lead singer, but I guess he plays guitar or something too. And for some reason, he held on to this check from, because I think when he went to cash or something, it was like insufficient funds or something. So he just like kept the check.
Weiland had insufficient funds? That rules.
Something like that. I don't know. I might be wrong. Right. It wasn't for very much. The check wasn't.
Right. So there's nothing of like note in the museum. It's one guitar.
No, he also has
flyers?
What he believes, though he can't verify, but he's pretty positive, is Eddie's actually very first guitar that he had as a child.
Oh, wow.
I forget the make of the guitar. I have a picture of it. But he found it. It's because it was such an unusual guitar, and he had a picture. Somehow he'd gotten a picture of Eddie's a little kid with this guitar, so he knew it was the first one, and he was in Altadena. Several years ago, he found the guitar that he believed was Eddie, so he bought it and then tried to verify through some acquaintances if it was it, and then someone said, yeah, it is it.
Wow.
Then, like a few years later or soon after that, he gets a call from like Eddie Van Halen's assistant or something. Word had gotten out that Dave had this guitar and Eddie wanted it.
He's like, I want my guitar.
And Dave was like, no.
So Eddie's like, oh, he tracked down my first guitar I ever had.
Yeah.
And he's like, I want it.
Yeah.
I'll buy it, whatever.
And Dave's like,
no.
Yeah, no. He's a weird guy.
That's so great.
And he's like, fuck, I don't care, man. I'm keeping it. I'm keeping it with this stuff, and it's part of my little museum.
So when he grew up with them and went to school, I mean, so he was part of the story or saw the story developing of Van Halen. He was going to all the parties.
Yeah. And he, too, was like a huge fan and agrees with all that. And now he's like, you know, they were fine until that David Lee Roth guy joined.
Oh,
you know,
is that his?
It's like a lot of people say with like Janis Joplin and Big Brother. It's like, yeah, they were great until that chick joined, you know?
Sure.
Yeah, kind of like that, you know, but he still has an appreciation for them, but he's pretty jaded about it.
Of course.
You know, it's like all of us. Like I say, like, man, Metallica was never as good as they were like on their first demo in those first few shows, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Same kind of deal.
Exactly. So that is, you know, we're talking about Pasadena. That is something to check out for people who want to.
Good luck.
Yeah, good luck. Who want to get their guitars worked on and
dude,
try to get
know,
in
I'm
the vault.
I'm a reporter. You know how long it took me just to like get a phone number for that guy and like find an email address, and I finally found one. Oh, I mean, I didn't go so far as to do like a records request or anything. I just finally found an email. I called a couple people. It's like, do you know this guy, Dave Anderson? They're like, no, I don't really have any contact for him. Then I found an email and I just like tried it a couple times. And finally, I got an email back. And he said, yeah, just give me a call. But he didn't give a number. I was like, fuck.
Oh, he emailed you, give me a call?
Yeah.
No number.
That's Dave Anderson, you know? And then it's like, oh, yeah, okay. And then he gave me his number. And then we finally did it.
2 weeks later, right? You get a phone
number?
Yeah,
pretty much. Pretty much. I was like, man, I need this story. Because the story was all about, they were coming out with the new record.
Right.
And I knew they had this history. As a kid, I had all the bootlegs and stuff. And a friend who's now living in Prague, he had recently given me a flash drive because he had, you know, over the years had accumulated like all these Van Halen bootlegs that were like killer from like way like 76, 77, demos, live stuff, which is why I knew about the shows Greg Ginn was talking about. And so he gave those to me. And so I knew that they had this whole prehistory, and I had heard that they were drawing from demos for the new record. And I said, wow, it'd be great to do a story about their time in Pasadena and how they formed. And so I tracked down a couple of people who saw them like back in the day, including Dave, you know, found a copy of David Lee Roth on Rodney on the Rock, like in 77 or 70. It's like right before the first record came out. Oh, no, they had done the demos for Gene Simmons at Casablanca, which were never released. But you can find out there, like on YouTube, and they're killer.
And actually, at that point, Gene was so, you know, I'm a huge Kiss fan. And in Gene Simmons' biography, he states that they were so great, that the Van Halen brothers, that when they were making Love Gun, when they came to L.A. after Rock and Roll Over,
right,
established themselves in LA for a while.
77, 78.
Yeah. They were making Love Gun, and the rest of Kiss was in New York. Gene befriended them and tried to, you know, manage them.
Yeah.
and actually demoed all the Gene songs on Love Gun with Alex and Eddie. So those are on the Kiss Box set.
Really?
Yeah. Christine 16.
The Van Halen demos are.
Well, it's Gene with Van Halen.
Demoing Kiss
songs. Gene
really?
Songs for Love Gun. Plastercaster. I think it's Got Love for Sale and Christine 16.
Right.
And at one point, he says this in his book. He's just like, I really wanted Alex and Eddie to replace Peter and Ace. And you know, there's that rivalry.
It wouldn't have worked. It would have all fell apart.
But that was like, he's like, these are the guys. They could play way better. And
I didn't think Gene really gave a crap about like the quality of the playing and Kiss.
I have no idea.
I mean, they just kind of like.
Well, I think he might. I think he, you know, being Mr. Alpha Male and being competitive, I think he was threatened by them.
I mean, it had to be at a certain level, yes.
I think he was very threatened by them because they're so damn good.
Yeah.
And here's like this. So think about music at that time. It's like Aerosmith and Kiss. Guys from New York, flamboyant, with leather, that could, you know, play, but not...
play.
You know, not play. And then here comes these guys from California with no shirt on, you
jumping
know,
around,
hair down their ass,
and,
you know, and just like... ripping backyards to pieces and playing circles around guys like Kiss and Aerosmith.
Yeah.
So it's like, whoa.
Wow.
You know what I mean? I mean, I think he was threatened by them. That's as like their ability and that kind of rock taking over the mainstream.
Yeah. You know, it was another band I love that he actually founded and, you know, toured with them.
Let me guess. John Lord?
No. They were
Black and Blue.
Nope.
Who? Cinderella.
No. No, it's same era. You're talking actually earlier. You're talking 75, 76. Actually opened a lot.
The Kiss shows?
Yeah.
Who?
We're signed to Casablanca. White outfits.
Really?
All in white. Punky Meadows. Angel, no. Dude.
Angel. Wow, you got me. You stumped me. You stumped me.
They wore all white, right?
Angel was from LA though, right?
No, they were from like East, like DC or something.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And they started out as kind of a proggy band, kind of heavy, you know, kind of a Deep Purple influence,
okay.
But the keyboardist played like he didn't do that, duh, that doomy organ.
Right.
Like, eerie, like John Lord. Yeah. He was more like,
right. More kind of proggy.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, their whole shtick was, you know, to be like the opposite of Kiss. Like we're all white, named Angel, the big white platforms, and very glammy, like kind of one of the first like real glam rock. I mean,
wow.
not like, you know, punk like the New York Dolls, but
more glam
pompy
rock.
Glam rock, but really like heavy.
That's
check
really
out their stuff. Man, I almost brought some. You know, you being a Kiss fan, because they have always been kind of a guilty pleasure. Like, I loved Kiss as a kid, and then...
Discover Black Sabbath, right?
Yeah, so of course I was like, who's this band Angel? It's opening for Kiss. They must be awesome. And so I got, like, their records, and I was like, wow, this is weird. This is nothing like Kiss. But another band who really, like, could play notes around Kiss. I mean, their music was so much more highly structured. The lyrics were more dense. It wasn't just about, like... you know, rock and roll all night, you know, cold gin, you know.
Right. It keeps us together.
Yeah. You know, Beth, I hear you calling, you know, whatever.
They're a bunch of weirdos when you think about it. They're weird. Right?
Kiss?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I'm still puzzled, like, why you like them so much. I mean, I liked them in my time, but I saw them as, we've had this conversation, I saw them as like kind of a gateway drug. And once, I mean, I was a fanatic as a kid. I mean, every inch of wall space was Kiss. But once I discovered, like, you know, Black Sabbath, Aerosmith, I was done.
I'll answer your question.
Yeah.
I've seen Kiss, I've seen Metallica, I've seen Slayer, I've seen Anthrax, and I've seen Megadeth, and Kiss never lets you down. Everyone on, I mean,
I've heard
has had a bad show, and I've seen those bad shows. It's like, really? So that's why I like them so much.
Yeah, they always deliver.
They always deliver. Full blast, full throttle, and never disappointed.
Wow. Yeah. But, I mean,
truth.
But most of the days of the year, all you have is like the records, you know?
I don't listen to them no more. It was more of like, that was my first introduction to music, period.
Okay.
So that's like, okay, oh, there's music. Wow. So Kiss was like my first.
I recently went back and just like listened like online, like, okay, you know, it's been a while since I listened to Kiss, and it's like they have, they're still revered by like, you know, bands I really respect and stuff. I must, you know, because sometimes you like, you'll forget about a band.
I think if you go back,
or you'll be like,
with experience, more experienced ears, you know, as time goes on, you're like, okay, this is not so bad. But it was bad.
It's bad. Now, there are a few songs here and there. They're like, yeah, I could have that. I think I could take like the first three or four records and make one like really killer, like 30-minute mix CD or
a
something.
A live one. That's the first three records. That's the best.
Yeah.
That's the best documentation.
Actually, they had some, the studio stuff on a live too, I think is really good.
Oh, I love it. Rocket Ride, All American yeah. Man, Larger Than Life. That's yeah. really good stuff.
And any song.
Kind of Cheap Trickish.
Yeah. And any song that Ace Frehley sings on, because it just sounds like fucked up and weird.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Shock Me and
Rock
and
Light, Save Your Love, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So
everyone's favorite Kiss member.
Oh, know? Always.
Mm-hmm. I was Peter Criss for Halloween once. Though.
Were you?
So, yeah.
Now let me ask you a question. Have you heard the Paul Stanley reel on SoundCloud? It's like all
no.
his banter for 20 minutes.
The banter, what banter? From when?
From any, like a reel of just different shows, him screaming, you know, talking to the crowd. It's just that. And people are like, they put it on Facebook and are like, how long can you last? You know what I mean?
I think they need to do the same with Ozzy. Too.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to take a break.
Okay.
Some more from Stephen Cuevas' playlist, and we'll be right back.
My handcrafted set list.
All right.
This is Ignacio Salcido from La Mascota Bakery. Studios.com.
Yeah.
To the sound of the monstrous clock, air is cleansed, assemble flock, like in the spring.
To the sound of the monstrous call.
welcome back to Los Angeles Nista. I'm Edward Solis, and my in-studio guest, Stephen Cuevas.
Hey,
how are you?
I'm still good.
You're still good. Now, let's talk about some other interesting things about Pasadena, the Huntington Library.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're a big Bukowski fan.
Oh, yes.
Now, why don't you tell the people out there what the library has?
Oh, the Huntington Library has the Charles Bukowski archives.
Right. Now, Jeremy.
Which include, you know, manuscripts, sure. Letters.
Sure.
You know, paintings, you know, art, the artwork that that Bukowski would do.
How long have you been a Bukowski fan?
I think I discovered him when I was working in a bookstore in the mid. I was in high school.
Oh, gotcha.
So that was like 1984, 83. So, he was still alive and stuff. And we used to get, you know, these books from Black Sparrow. And so I just picked one up one day. I think it was Ham on Rye and read it. And then I would special order the books straight from the Black Sparrow catalog. Like, they would usually, like, announce, like, okay, you know, new Bukowski coming out or whatever. And you could, Black Sparrow, who was, you know, his original publisher, they would always publish some in hardcover, but not too many. And even fewer were hardcover and signed. So I would try to get the signed ones. Mm-hmm. And you would just sign them and number them. They were like numbers in like the hundreds. Sometimes you could put a little drawing too. So I still have a few of those. I have my little Bukowski collection still.
Now, Jeremy, the owner of Skid Row, he's here with us. How mm-hmm. are you, Jeremy?
How's it going?
He's a big Bukowski fan. Have you
huge
been to the Huntington Library?
I was actually there for its opening day of that exhibit.
Yeah.
And got to meet like Linda Lee and those guys.
She's awesome.
Yeah. One of the great things on that exhibit was a wine glass that was kind of still stained with wine that kind of came right out of his room down in San Pedro.
Wow.
Yeah, no, I was telling Eddie, I did a story for KQED, for the California Report, on the exhibit. It was like a two-parter, and I mean, for KPCC, actually, it was a two-parter. And just about his life, his work life, and about the exhibit and some of the things in it. And I got to go to the house, actually. And
wow.
Yeah, and hang out with Linda.
I hear it's still kind of set up, you know, like.
Yeah, she still has his writing studio pretty much intact. His typewriter is up there. And I don't know if she does it for effect, but, I mean, there's like an ashtray. She doesn't smoke.
Right.
You know, she's like a real clean liver. She's like a Buddhist and stuff. And it's got like cigarette butts that she claims are his, that she still has up there.
Probably is.
And, and a couple of bottles of beer. They're like half empty. You know, I'm like, really? And an actual like typed, you know, poems that are like still up there. I'm like, Linda, shouldn't you do something? She's like, oh, no, yeah, it's fine. It's fine. Because she, part of the house, like she had remodeled. It's like climate controlled and stuff, where she has a bunch of other things that aren't at the Huntington yet. Artwork, you know, first editions, you know, manuscripts and stuff. So it's a bit weird, you know, it's a beautiful house. And she's such a great woman and very like super cool.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, I mean, so the Huntington has everything now. So you can really, it's more like for scholarship, like not just like some, you know, a drunken Bukowski fan can't go in there and say, hey, I want to see a manuscript for, you know, whatever. It's like, I think you can request to view things, but generally it's reserved for like students who are doing a paper or professors or, you know.
You could pull from the archives.
Someone researching a film, you know, that kind of stuff.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, and it's, it's manuscripts, artwork, first editions, weird ephemera. Linda actually gave me like some, you know, because I was telling her about my, you know, his influence on me, you know, as a writer, as a person and all that. And Black Sparrow, every New Year's, they would put out like one poem and they would like staple it and like it would have some original artwork and stuff. And they would send it out to the bookstores and to customers and stuff. And he would usually sign them. She still has a whole bunch of those. So she gave me like a little stack.
That's great.
From like all different years. I'm like, holy crap, man.
Wow.
I have a few of those actually with you know, the little man with the bottle or the dog or the bird or something.
It was
something.
Like the New Year's greeting from Black Sparrow Press. So now I have them like in a little plastic bag, like all kind of preserved and stuff. And it was like,
how long ago was that opening at Huntington Library?
A couple years ago, I guess, right?
Yeah. I remember it being announced a long time ago, and it really took them quite some time to get the collection together because there was just so much stuff.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, as far as other Pasadena destinations, are you fond of anything else that you can share? I mean, have you tried any restaurants?
Yeah, there's a cool restaurant. It's actually in Altadena, so it's like closer. It's like up to, I'm right on the border. I'm like, if you walk like, you know, 20 feet north, you're in Altadena. I love it up there. It's like, so you're like a mile from the foot of the San Gabriel Mountains and stuff. Mm-hmm. There's a Mexican restaurant called El Patron on Lake Street, which I can highly recommend. That's really my only big, you know, recommend that not a lot of people might know about. It opened just a few years ago. You know, me being Mexican, I'm pretty snobbish with Mexican restaurants. Sure. People always say like, oh, there's this killer Mexican place over here. And I go and it's like,
let's go, bro.
Great. Like another restaurant with like enchiladas with too much cheese and crappy sauce and, you know, overcooked chicken or whatever. I'm like, man, I'm not going to Mexican restaurants anymore. So, you know, actually one of the best restaurants, sorry, I'm like going off topic.
No, that's,
one of the best Mexican restaurants I've ever been in is in Prague, actually. It's called Cantina.
In Prague?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Now, why was it so good?
I don't know. There was just some Mexican family wound up there. There's actually a couple of them, but this one, they focus on cuisine from Michoacan, I think.
Oh.
So it's very regional specific.
Very regional specific. Yeah. And really honing
that's
on
coastal,
that.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Don't get mood, we spoke in French. You were past the shallow one. Isn't past the still a hunt? You were past the shallow one. Isn't past the still a hunt? Oh, I can see it now. Smiling as I pulled away. So great. I remember the letter I wrote in my hand. I love you, always filled my eyes. I remember the night we walked along the same.
Washington Boulevard, eastbound, 33. Can I get a transfer, man? 95 cents! Fuck you, I'll skate to the beach! And I'll look better getting there! Nothing I like more.
right, welcome back to Los Angeles Nista. I'm Edward Solis. My in-studio guest, Stephen Cuevas. Steven,
hey.
Are you still doing okay?
I am still doing okay. Wait, hold on.
Back.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
good. Yeah. Well, you know what? It's about that time, but before we wrap it up, I just wanted to, just pick your brain about being a reporter and having to deal with something called the internet, mm-hmm. or the interwebs and mm-hmm. Twitter and Facebook. Mm-hmm. Do you feel, for me, the outside looking in, it feels like a lot of people create their platform and call themselves reporters. And I think, mm-hmm. It's up to the reader to kind of sift out what's legit and what is maybe just being copied and pasted to a website. How do you feel about all that? How the internet interferes with reporting?
Well, I don't know. I mean, things like Twitter and even Facebook or any other social media has its place in journalism for sure. I mean, I suppose any, real journalist has to use them to some extent, or at least acknowledge that they're there. I have like a Twitter account, but I'm not very prolific. I don't know. I see things like Twitter as something that's very useful in disseminating information I like Twitter more as, I like to follow things or agencies or people where I think I can get ahead on a story. Like create your own kind of news wire. Like, so you can get on top of like breaking stuff or interesting news items. But as an actual tweeter, it's useful. Like if you're at a live event or covering a critical, council meeting or something.
Time sensitive stuff.
Or something controversial is going to be decided and you can be tweeting out, right? That's when it's, to me, I think is very useful. Or pictures from like, say the May Day March or a big demonstration, you can get stuff out right away.
Right.
And then like your station can sometimes retweet that to a larger audience.
Sure.
That's where I think it's useful.
And snowballs.
Yeah. But this whole thing about, random people like taking something from the New York Times and KPCC and then putting it up on their site or retweeting it or whatever. I mean, it's just a whole lot of noise and it's not...
It's like an air sandwich.
I don't know. I mean, even in public radio, you have this influx of, mostly younger people who are out of school and they're really savvy with social media and all these different platforms, but they have no or very little experience with just nuts and bolts reporting. And that may sound kind of like old farty, like, you need to go to the city council meetings. You need to, do the sort of, the sort of on the street reporting that, that's how you learn the craft. You don't learn how to write or ask questions or tell stories if you're just on Twitter all the time, or you're just like on your laptop or on your iPhone all the time. So, sure. I would challenge anyone who may be listening, who is thinking of, going into journalism. I don't know what the journalism, what the landscape's going to be like. I'd be terrified if I was, if I was a young person, because I don't know. The ground is shifting.
Constantly.
And we don't know if there's even going to be an LA Times in a few years, or who's going to be owning it.
Of course.
And
it keeps getting thinner and thinner.
And it's really sad because a lot of those people have been my friends and really, really good journalists, and we're losing them. They're going into academia or some other life, or they're going into smaller sort of news, or they're just trying to survive, and it sucks. And I think, that only is bad for everybody, because if no one's covering the city council or the water department or LAX, decisions that are being made, stuff is happening that no one knows about. You know what I mean?
Sure.
We're not smarter because of Twitter and all these other things. We're just not, because a lot of stuff is not being ferreted out and told that we have no idea about. And that's not some like conspiracy thing. That's just the truth, because there's fewer journalists to cover all that stuff. And, people don't want to pay for it, thank God, public radio does pretty well, and we have a pretty good base of people
that
continue to support. Yeah, sure. It's astonishing. As everyone else is declining, a station like KPCC has just been growing.
I can see
that. It's great. But, you know, it's a small, still a small station, even though they have a ton of reporters compared to like an LA Times, you know. So it's kind of depressing.
Well, I mean, the major market news outlets like LA Times, New York Times, it just seems like when you look into the statistics that, you know, of all the dailies, all their papers are shrinking.
Oh,
as
yeah.
As far as the pages.
When I moved to the Inland Empire like 8-9 years ago when I started there, the LA Times had like 5 or 6 people out there. They had an office. And I saw them all go one by one until there was just one guy, my friend David Kelly. He was like the last reporter, and he had this whole office to himself, and he sort of was holed up in what used to be the editor's office, and all the other desks still had, like, a lot of the reporters just left stuff behind, you know? So there was still like papers stacked. It was like, you know, like the rapture, when people get like raptured up to heaven.
Right,
you know,
the Twilight Zone, right?
Yeah. It was like one of the reporters left her sweater behind, was still on the chair, coffee cups like, and stuff. Yeah. I was like, man, David, this is spooky, man.
That is
like,
pretty spooky.
You know?
Well, on a positive note, you're based out of Los Angeles, and we look forward to hearing and seeing your stories on what website?
CaliforniaReport.org.
Right.
Or just, you know, Google Stephen Cuevas or Absolutely. California Report, and they can find it. Find your story and other things. So stuff stays archived there. So, and I think you can still find some of my stuff at KPCC's website. But
you can, actually.
You know, I think they pretty much stripped me out of there. You know, I was struck from the Book of Life when I left.
Oh, really?
Which is kind of sad. They didn't, you know, I don't know why they did that. Just like as a service, you would think you would want to keep all stories they've ever published. Like,
well, yeah, it's all relevant news archives.
I don't know. It's weird. It's a kind of a weird place now.
Maybe weird egos get in the way. Or
they do.
Yeah.
They do. And I probably shouldn't say any more than that.
Well, with that being said, Stephen, we're out of time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Eddie.
I appreciate it. And we'll see you guys next week.